Good evening. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator, and I'd like to thank you all for coming out for what's sure to be a terrific presentation. Couple of small items of business. As we begin, may I ask you please to silence all cell phones and anything might go beep or fleetle. Our speaker and the rest of the audience will appreciate it. I also want to mention, we know it's a little bit stuffy in here. Time of the year, it's a little hard to balance out. We have adjusted the air conditioning, so that should moderate as we go along. One more thing I wanted to mention. You may have noticed we switched to some lovely new designs for things like our events programs, and I left some incorrect text along the lovely design in this one. In the upcoming events page, the information on the event with Peter Carey next week is all correct. The information about the event on Istanbul Passage has the wrong date. It's October 2nd. Everything else is the same. So if it whets your interest, do pick up an events newsletter from the front desk. That has all the correct information on it, October 2nd. So Wendy Wasserstein joined the library in 1986. I knew her very slightly between 2001 and 2005, and I was always impressed by her wit and her gutsiness, even though one of the first things I heard from her made me roll my eyes. She was speaking to an audience of several hundred in October of 2001 on her book, Schick's a Goddess, and she started out remarking that she had trouble writing at home, too many distractions. So she said she'd come and write upstairs in our private study rooms, and she commented that they always looked like Dresden to me. There was a pipe with little peels, and you look out the window at bricks. Then she added something like, and of course you can't bring food in, so you slide your coffee under the table. And I was down in the audience saying, thanks a lot, Wendy. We really needed to advertise that you could sneak in your coffee to the private study rooms. Thank you. But then she went on to say, and I really thought to myself, there's something wrong with me because I feel most calm in this room. And I had to admit, what a perfect encapsulation of what so many of us feel about this library. She had her finger on the pulse, just as she did with feminism and women's roles in the immortal The Heidi Chronicles and the life of New York City across so much of her work. I might add that we have 4 signed editions of Ms. Wasserstein's works. They're in our special collections and are part of the Peluso family collection, so that's a nice little connection to her as well. Here to reintroduce us to Wendy's life and legacy, we're lucky to have Julie Salomon. As Wendy did with plays, Ms. Salomon has written one award-winning book after another, including Hospital, Facing the Wind, The Net of Dreams, Rambam's Ladder, The Devil's Candy, and The Christmas Tree. She's been a reporter and film critic for The Wall Street Journal and a staff culture writer for The New York Times. When not writing, she serves as chair of BRC, an organization serving the city's homeless, and on the board of a documentary project related to indigenous people of the Peruvian Amazon. An Ohio native, she was inducted into the Ohio Women's Hall of Fame in 2008. The New York Daily News says Julie Salomon is a hell of a journalist, and her Wendy and the Lost Boys is a hell of a story. Please join me in welcoming Julie Salomon.
Thank you so much. Can everybody hear okay? Great. That's my favorite quote, the hell of a. I've always, you know, when you're from Ohio, we like when people loosen up a little bit. So I always love that Daily News quote. I was really excited to come speak here tonight because Wendy Wasserstein did indeed do a lot of writing, or having spent a lot of time in the archive looking at her notebooks, a lot of not writing and doodling here at the Society Library. And she spent her high school years 2 blocks from here at 77th and Lexington Avenue, right next to the subway stop. There's a white apartment building, and that's where she lived with her parents, Morris and Lola Wasserstein. So coming here tonight was really revisiting Wendy's neighborhood, which I spent a lot of time in between 2008 and now. So I thought I would start off by telling you how this book got started. I'll read a little bit, but I know just hearing people read their own books can get pretty dismal unless they're Meryl Streep, which I'm not. So I thought I would just tell you a little bit about how this book came into being. I had just finished the publicity tour for Hospital, which was a book I had done for the Penguin Press, where Anne Godoff has been my editor for many years. And I was really tired. I'd been traveling around the country. I had 2 kids at home. I'm now an empty nester. Within the last 5 years, a lot has changed. And but I was really looking forward to going on vacation in Maine, where my family goes every summer. And literally the day before we were leaving for vacation to the Saddleback Lake, where there's no internet, no anything, freedom from email, when the phone rang and I picked it up and it was Ann Godoff, my editor, and she said, "I think I have an idea for your next book." Now, normally this would make me extremely happy, because the hardest part of writing a book is thinking about what should it be. And I can tell you, if there are writers in the audience, it's rare to have somebody make that telephone call. So I said, "What?" And she said, "What do you think about Wendy Wasserstein?" Now, I know, being the biographer of Wendy Wasserstein, I'm supposed to now say, I said, "Hallelujah," and jumped up with joy, but I responded the way I respond to everything, which was with extreme ambivalence. Just so you know, I started dating the man who's now my husband freshman year of college, and it took us 7 years to get married. And after we got married, it took us 10 years to have a kid. So I don't jump into things that lightly. So I said, but being a little more mature, I didn't say, "Oh, really? Is that a good idea? Would it be interesting to people outside New York? You know, playwright, would that be enough of a story? She's written so much about her own life. Is there anything left to tell?" I kept all of those thoughts to myself, and I said, interesting. I'll think about it while I'm on vacation, and hung up with a feeling of enormous satisfaction at my maturity and growth as a human being. But then over the next few weeks, after talking to various friends and advisors about it, and the reaction was very enthusiastic, and then starting to do a lot of research. So I started reading all of the many, many obituaries that were written after Wendy Wasserstein died, this outpouring of not just respect for an important writer, but genuine love for somebody who was a real daughter of this city. And all of that was incredibly interesting. But the thing that really grabbed me was a piece that Frank Ridge wrote in the New York Times at the end of the year when Wendy died. Wendy died in January 2006. She was quite young, 55 years old. And at the end of that year, Frank Ridge, writing in the New York Times, wrote that magazine every year does a roundup called The Lives They Lived. And it's not really so much obituaries, but a recap by various writers about people who had died that year who were significant. And Frank Rich wrote about Wendy Wasserstein, and they were very close friends. And he wrote about how she was this extraordinary person. She would walk down the street and people would come up to her. And it wasn't just that they would say, "I love your work." They would say, "How's your daughter? How's your mother? How's your weight? How's your boyfriend?" It was as though she were their best friend. And yet, he said, after she died in the subsequent months, following this huge memorial service for her at Lincoln Center, one thing that all these different people who she was friends with started to realize, that not that they knew a different Wendy, but they knew different pieces of Wendy, and that the Wendy they knew wasn't quite the Wendy they knew. And he wrote a line that was just chilling to me. He said, "How could the most public artist in New York, somebody who wrote about everything, it seemed, that was happening in her life, keep so many secrets?" Well, that was catnip. I'm a journalist, a writer, and I thought, what were those secrets? Because any of you who are familiar with Wendy Wasserstein's work, not just her plays, but the essays she wrote in The New Yorker, The New York Times, this was a woman who, 4 months after she gave birth to her child, had managed to, a very difficult premature birth, managed to get to her typewriter, she didn't use a computer, and type a 5,000-word article for The New Yorker about the birth of Lucy Jane in such incredible detail that it was mind-boggling. And so what were the secrets that she kept? This was a very intriguing question. And so that was my mission, going out to write about Wendy Wasserstein. And what I found were, her family called them secrets that weren't secrets, but they were the kind of secrets that I think every family has, one way or the other. They weren't secrets like she killed somebody or she had secret children living away someplace or various things. They were the kind of difficult secrets that happen when people live lives and have families that have arrived to the place they're at through difficult circumstances. So that was my mission. And so that was the personal side of the story, was to find out about that. That in and of itself was interesting enough. As I was doing the reporting, I started to realize that the other thing about Wendy that was so fascinating was that her work, probably most emblematic, the Heidi Chronicles, but the entire body of work, really was a reflection of such a significant moment in time. She really had her finger on the pulse of what was affecting the baby boom generation and especially the women of the baby generation and especially aspirational women of the baby boom generation. And so that became sort of an incredible context in which to put her story. So for me, as I began to write, it became not just Wendy's story, but the story really of not an entire generation, but an important subset of the generation. And so it was absolutely fascinating to see that somebody who was eccentric, who was a classic writer in a way, somewhat sort of outside the mainstream, managed to be exactly in the mainstream of a current that was moving fast and that embraced, engulfed an awful lot of people. And I think that's what people, that was the reason for this outpouring of grief when she died from strangers. Because somehow she managed to articulate for a great many people the things they felt but couldn't articulate or wouldn't articulate, even though there were so many things about herself that she kept inside. And so that makes her as great a character in some ways as any of the characters she created. Of course, they were all part of her, so I think that was one reason. And so I thought I would just read you a little bit from the book about the notion of secrets. And, of course, I think it's impossible to begin telling a story about Wendy Wasserstein without telling about her family. All of us are either beneficiaries or victims of our family, and often both. And she had an extraordinary family. In fact, Bill Finn, who himself is a very prominent person in the theater, a lyricist and a playwright, once said to, and a very close, one of the thousands of people who's one of Wendy Wasserstein's best friends, said to her once, "Wendy, you were born into great material." And boy, was she ever. So I just thought I'd read you a little bit from the beginning. It just sort of sets the stage for the family Wasserstein. Let other weaker families dwell on their sorrows. That was the unspoken philosophy in the Wasserstein family. Wendy would joke that when family members died, it was said, they went to Europe. More intricate heartaches were ignored. I will say, just an aside, that she had a much older sister, Sandra, who ended up living in England for a few years. But when Wendy, who was still a little girl when the sister left, heard that her beloved sister was leaving the country and going to Europe, she burst into tears because she thought it meant she'd never see her again. Secrecy pervaded the household, though the family would deny that anything was hidden. "It's not that there were secrets. Things were just not talked about, never mentioned," said Bruce Wasserstein, Wendy's brother. "It was what my parents wished." The family produced uber achievers. Wendy became the first woman playwright to win a Tony Award and a Pulitzer Prize, while also achieving commercial success on Broadway. Sandra Wasserstein Meyer, the eldest, became a high-ranking corporate executive at a time when the best job available to most women in Fortune 500 companies was boss's secretary. Their brother Bruce became a billionaire superstar of the investment banking world. Even Georgette Wasserstein Levis, the middle daughter, who checked out of the race early, married young, had babies, moved to Vermont, ultimately became the successful owner of a large country inn, the Wilburton. The Wasserstein children held Morris, their sweet father, in special regard as the source of comfort, quiet wisdom, and unconditional love. Morris and Lola were said to be the perfect couple, though it was also said their marital bliss was helped by the fact that Morris was practically deaf, his hearing damaged by illness when he was a boy. When he needed peace and quiet, he just turned down his hearing aid. A decent, hardworking man, Morris Wasserstein had brains, foresight, and ambition, but not the fierce personality that produces titans or playwrights. For the myth-making ingredient, look to Lola. She was of minuscule size, but a powerhouse contender among legendary heavyweights, Jewish mother division. Lola was the lightning rod, credited or blamed for her children's drive, their idiosyncrasies, their outside successes, and peculiar flaws. Lola's stories were legion. Perhaps most emblematic were those told about after Wendy won the Pulitzer Prize. Lola was said to have responded in at least two ways. I'd be just as happy if she married a lawyer. Did you hear? Wendy won the Nobel Prize. Either way, the clear message was that the Pulitzer wasn't quite good enough. On the other hand, anything her children did was de facto the best. Lola decorated the walls of her apartment with lacquered collages of Wendy's press clippings and playbills, as well as articles about her other children. Their framed diplomas, school photos, and prizes were on display. Lola said her chest was puffed out so much that she needed a bigger bra. That particular paradox of being better than everybody else but not good enough would become a recurrent theme in Wendy's life and in her work. In the Heidi Chronicles, the superior-inferior concurrence emerges when Heidi Holland, the heroine, is invited to speak at an all-girl prep school that she'd attended. Heidi, by then a well-known art historian, has a meltdown as she enumerates the way she feels that women of her generation have failed one another. Discussing all the women she meets in her gym's locker room, she erupts into a fantasy about what she'd like to say to them. "I'm sorry, I don't want you to find out I'm worthless," she said, "and superior." The problem may have been that Lola never explained what would happen to the child who couldn't produce achievements that could be quantified and displayed. Would she be worthy of love? So what that is alluding to is the brother Abner. It was a very complicated family, the Wassersteins. Lola was, both parents were immigrants who came here at a very young age, well before the Second World War. And Lola originally married George Wasserstein. They had two children, and then George died of appendicitis, victim of history. If he'd gotten appendicitis a couple years later, there would have been penicillin, and he would have been probably fine. Instead, he died, and Lola married Morris, and then they had three children, but never told the younger three children until they were much, much older that Morris was not the father of all five children. Abner, who was the second son from the first marriage, was a normal little boy, and when he was five, nobody knows exactly what happened. He started having epileptic seizures, and he ended up becoming brain damaged and again was sent away to a school and again was somewhat disappeared. The parents continued to visit him, but the other children, he just didn't exist anymore. And Abner, the presence and absence of Abner's, I think, was hugely influential in Wendy's life. But that's the sad part of the story, and I think behind every great comedian, you often find a lot of tragedy, and Wendy was no exception to that rule. But she had an incredible gift of taking the raw material of life and turning it into a story. Her brother Bruce once said he looked at her work as a kind. He said she had the Cuisinart approach to writing. She would take in all this material, put it in the Cuisinart, and then the characters would come out re-diced and spliced and reconfigured, and then people could kind of guess who was what and what happened when. But I think, as I said earlier, for me, the most interesting part of Wendy, the superior, inferior question, which I think is not uncommon to children of immigrants in particular, people who, one of the strivers of this world who want to belong, want to become part of the leaders of society, but are never quite sure if they fit in. I think that was huge for her. And she grew up in Brooklyn, and then when the parents started to make money, they moved to Manhattan, and Wendy went to Mount Holyoke. And I don't know if there are any Mount Holyoke people here. Usually there are some. But the Mount Holyoke experience, which was not particularly happy while she was there, became very happy for her afterwards when it became the fodder for Uncommon Women and Others, the play that put her on the map, and also just informing her idea of who she might be. And most importantly, her 4 years at that college, she entered in 1967 when, you know, there's very funny material. I spent a lot of time in the Mount Holyoke archive, and the freshman handbook from Mount Holyoke was hilarious. It told the girls, and they were girls, what to eat, what to wear. Don't forget that freshman 15 won't let you fit into that silver lamé dress. And they were told, you know, these were bright women, and at the gym orientation, one of the young women remembered that they were told they should take tennis and golf because it would be good for their husbands' careers. But while she was at Mount Holyoke in 1967, it was still probably in the 1950s, and within a year or two, the revolution came, and everything was turned upside down. And now instead of marrying a lawyer or a doctor, you were supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer. And it was exhilarating and confusing. And Wendy really captured, I think, the feeling of that time for an awful lot of women. It was interesting. Mount Holyoke has been really terrific about the book, and they ended up doing, because coincidentally, last year was the 40th anniversary of Wendy Wasserstein's graduation from college. So the archivist there really was amazing, and they ended up putting on this whole exhibition about Wendy's life with a prominent and maybe an especially extra large space devoted to the time at Mount Holyoke, but it deserved it in a lot of ways. And in the course of that exhibition and that experience, they really laid out, I think for them it was a chance to examine this period of history, but in the spring, they put on Uncommon Women and Others, the undergraduates, which had not been put on at Mount Holyoke for 20 years when Wendy Wasserstein won an award that year, because the drama department has not been pro-Wendy at Mount Holyoke until now. She's having a renaissance there, but they were into more avant-garde theater. But they put on Uncommon Women and Others, and it was the first time I had seen a live production. I'd seen all of her other plays on stage or near, but I arrived slightly after Uncommon Women had been put on, so I'd only seen the PBS version. The television version is available at the Lincoln Center Performing Arts Library, or I guess you can order it on Amazon as well. Seeing that play put on at Mount Holyoke by these Mount Holyoke was absolutely incredible. And then afterwards, some of the young women in the theater department did a 45-minute cabaret called Uncommon Women with a Y that was sort of their riff on Wendy Wasserstein and Uncommon Women. And it was a play about contemporary undergrads at Mount Holyoke trying to make sense of this play and trying to find relevance in it. And it was actually fantastic, because they really captured what was timeless about her work, what was contemporary about it, and it was just exciting to see this passage from one generation to the other, although it shouldn't have surprised me, because it's been funny in the course of writing the book and then going around promoting it, I have been amazed at how many young women of my daughter's age, she's 22, have performed part in Uncommon Women. Apparently it is extreme. There's a cleaned up version with no foul language in it for high school. And almost every girl plays a role in this when they're in high school, because it has so many wonderful parts for women or for you know, teenagers. And so it was actually really funny that there's this whole other little sub cult group of Wendy acolytes. And, oh gosh, I've been talking in half an hour. I can continue talking, but I don't know if you have questions, because I know a lot of times people have. So if you have questions, I'm happy to talk in response to your questions, or I can just keep talking. Have any? Keep talking. Oh, wait. Question, and then I'll keep talking. Wendy and the Lost Boys. What? Why? Okay, see, this is perfect. The question gives me a perfect way to keep talking. So Wendy and the Lost Boys comes from many sources. The first and most obvious is Peter Pan, because Wendy, like so many women of her generation, were named after Wendy of the famous Jane Barry story and play. In my book, it has many connotations. One, Peter, the book is also about the baby boom generation, which has often been called the Peter Pan generation, the generation that refused to grow up. So part of it's an allusion to that. And part of it is an allusion to Wendy had many so-called best friends, but she had a very strong inner group of gay men from the theater who were her dear, dear friends, and who, when she became friendly with them, flirted with marriage, with trying to figure out how to be a family in the new world that was emerging in the 70s and 80s. And the title actually occurred to me, to go back to how I got into this book. Andre Bishop, who is the artistic director at Lincoln Center and was the artistic director at Playwrights Horizon, was Wendy's great friend, producer, mentor, and literary executor. And before I was able to do this book, I had to be auditioned by Andre, because if he didn't approve of me, then there would be no book, because he would determine whether people would talk to me or not, and most important, whether I could quote from Wendy's work. And Andre was Wendy's closest friend, and I remember the day that the seeds of the title were planted. Andre was telling me, he was born a few years before Wendy, I think in 1946, and when he was a little boy, 6 or 7 years old, his aunt took him to see Mary Martin playing Peter Pan on Broadway. And he was a tiny little boy, and when he told me the story, I got chills. He said, that day I knew I was going to be in the theater. I didn't know how, but I just knew it. And he certainly followed through on that intuition he had as a six-year-old. And I can't tell you how many people I interviewed had some Peter Pan connection. It was almost eerie. The name Wendy, after the Mary Martin play, went like this in terms of popularity. So if you know women in their 50s and early 60s, there's a good chance their name is Wendy. And so that was where the title came from. You know, it's an interesting thing when you're writing a book about somebody's life. It's bizarre, actually, because who are we? Are we the depressed person who writes in our journals? Are we the happy person who writes letters? And with Wendy, in particular, because she was such a dramatist, deconstructing who she was such a mystery. So just so you know a little bit about the process for me of doing this, it was an unusual biography because my subject was no longer alive, but she had died young, and she had died quite recently. When I began the research, she had only died 18 months before. So what I ended up finding was that I ended up doing a kind of triangulation. So on the one hand, there was the body of material she wrote, her work, hundreds of articles for everything ranging from Mademoiselle magazine and the Farmer's Almanac to the New York Times. She wrote for a very broad range of publications. And thank God, the internet hadn't gotten to blogging too much yet, because I can only imagine what kind of blogger she might have been. But so there was all that material. Then at Mount Holyoke in the archive, there are, 65 feet, I think was the, a lot of feet of material. Letters, the hardest part were, a lot of it was, it sounds horribly daunting, which it was, it's not quite as bad, because a lot of it was just retyped versions of manuscripts. But then the way she wrote everything in longhand in college ruled notebooks. And what she would do, she would write two or three pages, cross out, cross out, cross out. And then she would have a shopping list. Celery, da-da-da. And then she would have the most intimate diary. And so I had to read through every single page because you never knew where anything was going to show up. She was not a very organized person. One of her assistants said that when he packed her up to move from 1/5 Avenue, oh no, she, that was one of the she assistants, when she packed her up to move from 1/5 Avenue uptown, she found in the closet just piles of papers and garbage bags, and she found checks for $10,000 that hadn't been cashed. I mean, she would just throw stuff. She was not that organized, to put it mildly. So there was the written material there. There was the material from the archive, and then there were the interviews. I did 300 interviews. Now, I know that sounds psychotic, but this is a woman who had so many friends and acquaintances from so many different parts of her life. And no matter how many people I interviewed, more people kept popping up. And among those were people like Chris Durang, who was a dear friend and one of her literary executors. And Andre, I had to interview over and over and over again because they became more and more important to the story. And so it was a fascinating project because in the end it became a little bit like detective work. You know, I'm the judge and jury ultimately trying to decide where is the truth. Because even when Rendy was writing a journal entry, it was hard to know. Was she writing this as a journal entry or was she writing it for posterity? I mean, there was literally an entry where she said, "Dear Diary," this was one of her few actual diary entries, and this was when she was at Yale Drama School and had met Chris Durang, another gay man she had a crush on. "Dear Diary, I've just met Chris Durang, who is so cute and, you know, et cetera, et cetera." And then she says, "And for future readers, he is really talented." Now, maybe that was just a literary quirk, or was she thinking of future readers at age 22? You know, it was sort of eerie trying to figure out the workings of her mind. And so the interviews became hugely important and also made me realize that probably most biographies we read of historical figures are fiction because things that people write are really hard to verify. And even having done this elaborate system of testing and retesting and evaluating, I think I have a kind of accuracy, but I don't know how Wendy would feel about it. Would she read this and say, "Oh, yeah, that's me," or think, "What the hell?" You know, it's really hard to know. Question? Yes. The question is, how did she deal with her illness? With a lot of secrecy. And that was one of the reasons her friends in that last year that led Frank Rich to write that article were very upset with her. Because on the one hand, you say, why is she obliged to tell people about her illness? On the other hand, she had a gift for making every person she was friendly with think that they were her best friend, her nearest and dearest. And so very, 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 very few people knew how ill she was. Nobody, except not even her doctors. I mean, she would go to, she was determined not to be sick and not to be dying. And in fact, I had originally written the first chapter of the book as the last year of her life because it was so extraordinary. She was seriously ill with a kind of rare form of leukemia. She had a 4-year-old going on 5-year-old child as a single mother. She was writing her one and only novel. She was working on Third, which was her last play. She was supposed to do a teaching round at Princeton, which she didn't do, but she did do the first part of a teaching rotation at Dartmouth. She did the McDowell call. She did an extraordinary amount of traveling, talking, writing, all these things going on, and she was dying. So I thought, wow, that's a great beginning to a book, little thinking that, of course, every time you mention a person, you have to then explain who they are. So the first chapter was becoming unmanageable, let's say. And in the end, I realized, okay, now you have to go back to the beginning. But she did not handle her death well. And by that I mean she didn't have a new will for her daughter. How she had not really designated an appropriate guardian. She did not want to die. She was not ready, and she was not acknowledging. And nobody was really helping her acknowledge. Because I think any time a doctor got too close or too interested in telling her, she just went someplace else. Very interesting, yes. Could everybody hear the question? What was reaction from people in the book to about revealing things that they might have not known? It's been unbelievably positive in general after initial horror, I should say. So one example, Terrence McNally, well-known playwright, well-known gay playwright, openly gay, one of the first playwrights to write about gay life in New York. But he and Wendy became involved in a relationship and decided that they might actually get married. They might have a child together. This was the 1980s, at the height of the AIDS epidemic. Terrence McNally had lost a lover, and he was turning 50. He kind of wanted a family. He thought he liked Wendy. You know, people were trying to sort out what to do. And their relationship, that aspect of it, was kept secret, not because of him, but because of her. She didn't want it to be public. In the archive, now when you give your papers to an archive, you know that they, unless you specifically designate them as reserved to not be open till the next century or the next century after that, they're open to the public. She left a copy of a letter she had written to Terrence when he broke up with her and went back had a male lover at that point. He broke up with her, and she wrote this very dramatic letter saying how deeply disappointed she was, and it was very angry. It was a breakup letter. And so I had this letter from Mount Holyoke. Now, meantime, before this, I had had many lengthy conversations with Andre Bishop about his, on the record with a tape recorder, about he and Wendy discussing maybe a few years earlier, discussing getting married, and then he decided he didn't want to do that, and how angry she was when he became involved with somebody and they decided to adopt a child. So Andre had been very open, and I'd gone back and we'd clarified. So I thought, okay, this is a group, you know, everybody's very open about all of this. So when I went in to interview Terrence McNally, I came in with this letter from Mount Holyoke thinking, I'm just going to ask him about it like it's, you know, when did you go shopping for laundry last time? You know, thinking it was not really a big deal. And I brought the letter out at some point in the interview, and he went ballistic, not at me, at Wendy. And he wasn't even mad that she had left it public, but he was angry that she had made such a big production out of keeping everything secret. So he had honored that. Now, he had been living with a man for many years who he subsequently married, and he hadn't told him. So it was like that. So I was very, very nervous about what his reaction was going to be when the book came out. And he was lovely. He wrote me. He didn't read it for the longest time. I sent copies of the book to everybody significant who I interviewed. And I didn't hear from him for a really, really long time. So I thought, ooh, this isn't good. And then one day out of the blue, he just wrote me a beautiful note. So, you know, other than that, there may be people who hated it, but they haven't told me. They've been blissfully talking about me behind my back. Yeah. The paternity of Lucy Jane, you know, I know everybody thinks that there's some secret father hidden. I think Wendy actually in that case was pretty honest about who the father was. I think the father was a sperm donor from a bank, and I think he is. In many of her private writings, she talks about lot number 1125 or 75, whatever it was, but she turned it in to a question and a mystery. When she wrote that article in The New Yorker, which I think is one of her most extraordinary pieces about Lucy Jane, she kind of wrote it in a way that left open the possibility that there was a real live Prince Charming lurking in the background. But I really don't think there was. I mean, I'm 99.9% sure. You're never 100% sure because I wasn't exactly in the room. And she was so secretive. But I think it was just part of her desire to keep everything interesting. Yes. You go and then you, that's fine. After Bruce Wasserstein died, who took over the care of Lucy Jane? Well, that's another saga within a saga, because when Wendy died, Bruce was married to Claude Wasserstein. She was his third wife. They had two Lucy Jane's official guardian was Pam Wasserstein, who was Bruce's oldest daughter from his second marriage. And Pam, who's a lovely young woman, I mean, I think when Wendy put her in the will, it was thinking, I think it was before Lucy Jane was born, or maybe when she was born, and she was thinking, you know, 30 years hence. And so when Wendy was very sick, and Pam was unmarried in her 20s, this was not a responsibility she was ready to take on, that's when Claude and Bruce became Lucy Jane's guardian. They had two boys. They have two boys who are roughly same age group. And then they got divorced a year later, and Claude and Bruce had joint custody. And then after Bruce died, Claude maintains custody of Lucy Jane. And as far as I can see, the entire family, all of Bruce's older children, they're all very close to her. They've all stayed in very close contact. Let me ask this lady and then you, because she was a... could everybody hear the question? Yes, that's the answer. Yes, she laughed it off and it did great damage. Lola, Wendy's mother, became almost an exercise addict, I should say. She was remarkably thin. And if you look at pictures of Lola, she got thinner and thinner as she got older and stronger. She was scary. When she died, she was in her 90s and looked like she could flatten anybody. And she always pointed out to Wendy how slovenly she was and how overweight she was. But again, she was also so proud of her and bragging about her. So it was, but I think she did a number. There's a horrible event that Wendy wrote about, actually, that one day Lola, who used to like to wear her leotard under her fur coat, and they were walking up Park or Fifth together, and Lola says to Wendy, look at that woman. She's looking at you and saying, look at that fat girl over there. I mean, she could be pretty devastating. Yes. She always made a joke out of her weight problem. She was constantly on diets. She had very beautiful legs. She had long, slender legs, and she always wore clothes that accentuated them. She would wear shorter skirts and so on. So she liked to look attractive, but she also had terrible hygiene. Sometimes she wouldn't shower, even after she had become a well-known person. She had a lot of manifestations of somebody who did not have a very good self-image, I would say. And yet, sometimes, the extraordinary thing about Wendy and doing the research and putting the pictures together was that within a very short period of time, she could look completely attractive, put together, well-groomed, or she could look like a homeless person, completely lost, not knowing what to do. But the joke about her was that, in general, her look was a sweater from Chanel buttoned crookedly and something sticking out. So she could name a designer label from 50 yards. She always had beautiful shoes. She was wearing Manolo Blahnik before Sex and the City was on television. But she always managed to make it look like Kmart. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, that all three of those children died young, and that the parents both lived quite to nice ripe old age. Yeah, very tragic. And that's why sometimes doing, when I was writing the book, some of it was just so much fun and exhilarating, really, to write. I mean, my favorite parts of writing the book were writing about Wendy's discovery of herself as a writer and making all these friends and just the fun of New York and the late 70s and 80s, when it was also grim but also exciting, and all these young people coming here creating the off-Broadway theater, which we now take for granted, but is fairly recent. So it, just as a piece of somebody who was actually at the heart of that history, was so exciting. But then it becomes so tragic, so sad, and especially because, you know, Bruce also was such a tragic figure because, on the one hand, the billionaire with so many wives, each one more beautiful than the next, and yet so much heartache, and a very close family. That was the other thing that was pretty interesting about the Wassersteins. I mean, they are a tribe, and they are intensely close, but in a good way, despite all this craziness. It's a very interesting family because they seem to have every possible impulse going into a family dynamic. Questions? Yes. The question is, did she, even after all the research, was she elusive or did I grasp her? I think both. I know I keep answering that, both, yes. Maybe that's being an ambivalent, but it's true. You know, there were moments when I felt so connected to her. I think especially when she was younger, especially when she was going through her search for identity, was very familiar. Later on, the trajectory of her life was odd to me. It was the way she, there was almost a disconnect between, there was such a disconnect sometimes between the way she behaved and the way she wrote that it became harder to feel that I really grasped her. And yet there were so many times when I was writing about different events in her life right up to the end that felt very palpable to me, that I did feel, you know, even the secrecy about her illness, I felt I understood her reasons. And so in the end, I guess I felt the way a lot of her friends did, that sometimes I loved her, sometimes I wanted to grab her and shake her, and other times I felt mystified by her, you know. And I think the other thing that I kept thinking about was the way she was an incredible friend to people. And I think a lot of that sense of loss that people felt afterwards and anger was that they may not have been quite as good friends back, that she was really good listener. She was good at taking it in. And I think in a way a lot of people felt guilty because they weren't so good at reciprocating. Any other questions? That's an interesting question. You know, there are a lot of similarities, but clearly a lot of differences. I mean, I didn't know Nora Ephron, but certainly from the outside, she seems to have managed her personal life in a way that makes more sense in a conventional way. You know, she certainly lived an unconventional life as well, but I think was able to manage it better, I think. So thank you very much. I appreciate your being such a great audience. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming, and thanks to Julie for a wonderful, wonderful presentation. We do have books for sale outside, and she'll be happy to autograph them for you. So thanks once again.